So at this time, I would like to introduce our speaker, Corey L. from Wetumpka, Alabama. So Corey's shared with us before, and we're glad to have her back again. This is the first virtual one, so I introduce you to Corey. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this. My name is Corey Long. I'm a very grateful and enthusiastic member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. I want to thank Debbie and the committee for inviting me to do this. I was really bummed I wasn't going to get to come to Boise to do it. But as it turns out, God's got a plan, because had I been coming to Boise in person, I wouldn't actually have been able to come to Boise. I told Debbie earlier, I'm sitting in my, it's not actually technically my office. I'm in my building. I've gone down the hall to another office. We've had an emergency motion come in, and so we're working over the weekend. I've been here since 7:30 this morning. I've been up since 4 this morning to make sure that I got my prayer and meditation in, the walk with the dog in, my run on the treadmill in, and I got my second COVID vaccine yesterday. So far, so good. No side effects other than a sore arm. If I keel over here, somebody call 911, but I don't think I'm going to. So I'm just grateful to be here. I've been thinking a lot about this week and last week and the week before that. And then all this stuff happened at the office. So it's like, all right, I obviously need to do this. Before I start, I'm going to say a prayer, mainly for me, but I hope it helps you guys too. And I have new reading glasses, so I look very intelligent, and it's just a look. May we be well, happy, and peaceful. May no harm come to us. May we always meet with spiritual success. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May we always rise above them with morality, integrity, forgiveness, compassion, mindfulness, and wisdom. Oh, so I've been thinking about how I want to do this. I've got this very large desk. I have no cards all over it. We'll see if I actually use them. According to our calculations, I'm going to do steps 1 and 2 between now and what is actually 2:50 my time. I think it's 1:50 your time. I'm then going to do, I know the agenda says steps 4 through 10. I'm going to do steps 4 through 9 from 3 o'clock my time to 3:50 my time. And then I'm going to do steps 10 to 12 from 4 o'clock my time to 4:50 your time. And just know that I'm an hour ahead of you guys. So we've got that going. I'm going to try and talk about the steps as I've done the steps, as I've worked through the steps, and I've walked through the steps a number of times. I'm going to try and keep it focused on when I worked them the first time, when I came in 1998, and when I work them now in 2021. All right, that note card's done. Yay. I want to tell you a little bit about how I got here and why I stay here. So I told you my name is Corey Long. I am from Wetumpka, Alabama. You might notice I don't have a Southern accent. I came down here for a job, and I stayed because of a guy. And I'm still here with a guy, but not the same guy I stayed for. So we've got that going for us. I got here on September 18th, 1998, because I married a man who's afflicted with the disease of alcoholism. I married a really great guy. I absolutely adore my husband. He is my best friend on the planet. I have his permission to break his anonymity. We like to laugh a lot. I prefer it when we laugh at him. He prefers it when we laugh at me. But if I say anything that sounds like I'm denigrating an alcoholic today, please know that I'm not. I love alcoholics. I think they are the most fabulously interesting, fun, exciting, dangerous people I know. And because they're so different from me, I'm fascinated by them. Most of them terrify me, but I'm still fascinated by them. So when I got here in September of 1998, I got here on our 2-month wedding anniversary. I had waited almost 36 years to get married, and the man that I married was a raging alcoholic. And I did not think there was anything wrong with me that his not drinking would not fix. So when I got here, I got here because my husband went to treatment. And he said to me, I just want to share a little bit about what I was like the week before we got here. Well, maybe not the week, maybe a couple of months before I got here. So before Kent, the guy that I actually stayed in Alabama for, that relationship didn't end. I know everybody's stunned by that. I had given him a credit card, but I am not really a slow learner. I knew not to give Kent a good credit card. So I gave him a gas credit card. He could only go to the gas station with it, because, you know, that's how I'm going to control what's going on. And So Kent and I, he moved down here to be with me in 1997. And I gave him the credit card and we got married in 1998. And he got sober in September of 1998. So, and we got married in July of 98. So around probably June of 1998, for some bizarre reason, I thought the credit card company was trying to screw me because they were not sending me the bill. So I did what I know to do, which is call the credit card company up and cuss them out. Why have you not sent my bill? And they said, well, have you moved? No, I've not moved. I'm in the same place I've been in for the last 6 years. We're so sorry. We'll send you another bill. They send me another bill. I don't get the other bill. Now I am convinced they're just trying to screw me. And between the time I started calling the credit card company, it was the only credit card that Ken had. By the time I started calling the credit card company and the time he got sober, I must have called them about 12 times and getting progressively more and more angry with them because I was convinced they were intentionally holding my bill. They were trying to ruin my credit, you know? And when Kent got sober, he said to me, if you're looking for the credit card bill, I'm like, what do you mean looking for the credit card bill? They haven't sent the credit card bill. He had all 12 of the credit card bills in his top dresser drawer. And it never occurred to me that he was getting the credit card bill before I got the credit card bill. Never occurred to me to ask him. So when I came to you, and I came to you on September 18th, 1998, and you told me I was powerless. I didn't quite understand that. So I'm yelling at service people. I'm yelling at the people at the credit card company. I'm yelling at people at the airport. My thought is, if you're not doing what I want you to do, you must be trying to screw me in some form or fashion. I have to protect myself. That was my idea. And then the week before we got here, in the summer, my father had convinced my husband to invite his parents to our wedding because when Kent and I got together, he said, I'm estranged from my parents. Kent was 36 when we married. And I said, why are you estranged from your parents? He said, oh, it's a long story. You don't need to know. And I thought, okay, fine. I don't need to know. But right before the wedding, he said to me, they don't know I drink, which I thought was odd because he's 36. And he said, oh, it's a long story. You don't need to know. And so I said, fine. He said, so what I need to do is we need to buy a refrigerator and put it in the bedroom so that I have beer in the refrigerator when they're here and they won't know I'm drinking. And I thought that made perfect sense. All right, fine. If they don't know and they don't need to know and I don't need to know, we'll just buy a refrigerator. So we bought a refrigerator and we put it in the bedroom. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. So that's in July. And then we come up to September and it's the week before he gets sober. And we went off to play putt-putt golf. I stink at putt-putt golf, but I like it. And so we drove about an hour and a half to play putt-putt. And the only way I can describe my husband to you, they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, restless, irritable, and discontent. We have friends in Canada who describe it as itchy, bitchy, and twitchy. And that's a much better description. He was really, really grumpy and cranky. And I couldn't figure out why. And so we were at the putt-putt place for about 10 minutes. And we'd driven an hour and a half to get there. And I did not know that my husband could drink or he could do stuff. But he couldn't do them both at the same time. So I said to him, do we need to go? And he said, yes. And I said, okay. And as we were walking to the car, I do not know to this day why I said what I said. But I said to him, do we need to stop and buy you beer for the ride home? And everything about my husband in that moment changed. Everything. And the only thing he said was, no. That's how I heard it. And we didn't talk. We got in the car. We drove all the way home. Didn't speak. Didn't speak for the rest of the day. Kent and I, to this day, have not talked about that day. I talk about it a lot, but we've not talked about it. But I don't know what you do with that information. I know what I do, which is I just act as if it's all going to be fine. It was an anomaly. We don't really need to talk about it. Let's not flesh this out. Let's just go on, move forward. That was on a Saturday. The next Thursday, I leave the house screaming like a lunatic. I am the one yelling and screaming. I am the one slamming the doors. I am the one cussing, right? My husband is doing what he always does, which is sitting on the chair in the living room drinking beer. He's not doing anything different than he hasn't been doing for the last year. I'm the crazy woman. I am the one screaming like a lunatic. I had to go to a professional meeting. I left the house. I slammed the door as if that's going to get his attention in some form or fashion. I go off to this professional obligation. And on the way home, I heard a voice as clear as a bell in my head said, you need to go to Al-Anon. Now, this is what I know about myself, having done enough inventory work on myself. If I don't know what something is, it clearly cannot be important because don't you know, I know all the important stuff. So I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I don't know that I'd ever heard of Al-Anon before. So I disregarded the thought that you need to go to Al-Anon. I walked into the house. It was 10 o'clock at night on September 17th. And my husband said to me, I cannot quit drinking without help. And I went, yes, yes, let me help. I'm so good at helping. Got the Blue Cross Blue Shield. I'm figuring out what to do. And we took him to treatment the next day. And when we went to treatment, and this is where you guys got me. The intake nurse said, name. And he gave his name and I gave his name. And they said, birthday. And he gave his birthday and I gave his birthday. And they said, how much do you drink a night? And I said, 18. I said, 8 beers a night. And he said, 18 beers a night. Before I could whip around on him about the 18 beers a night, the intake nurse looked at me and she said, what are you, his mother? And I was insulted and offended. I thought she was suggesting I looked old and tired. We have pictures. I did look old and tired, but I was insulted. I was a newlywed, for God's sakes. How dare she suggest I look like his mother? I know today what she was suggesting. I was acting like his mother, and I was acting as if he was 12 or 10. And then she promptly kicked me out of her office, which I thought was a little extreme. And she sent me down to the family counselor. And this is what I heard the family counselor say to me. If you love him, you will go to Al-Anon. And I thought, how dare you suggest I don't love him? I've just married him, for God's sakes. Fine, I'll go to Al-Anon. So I didn't come for any of the good reasons. I didn't come because I thought I wanted it, didn't come because I thought I needed it. I didn't even know what it was. But this is what I do, because I cannot show up someplace not knowing what I'm doing, or at least not pretending like I know what's going on. I went home and got onto an online Al-Anon meeting. It was not anything like this. It was one of those like chat room things where you just type sentences and stuff. And everybody in that meeting was so kind to me. They were so kind to me. And every single person in that meeting said, get to a meeting in person. And I thought it was because they were being kind. I know today it was because I was interrupting every 30 seconds. And so I went, that was my first Al-Anon meeting, was an online meeting. And I went to the next meeting was at the treatment center the next day. And in that meeting were three little old ladies. And I say little old ladies, it was Adrian and Eunice and Carol, I believe her name was. And we just lost Adrian a couple weeks ago. She was 86, I think, when we lost her, which means she was under 65 when I met her. And I thought, wow, I thought she was 103 if she was a day. And these three little old ladies were in this meeting and they said to me, oh, honey, they'll drink again. They all drink again, but have hope. And I burst into tears because I thought it was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard. But they also said, the answers are in the literature. And I got the literature. I bought every book that they had that was an Al-Anon book. And within the first week, I had every book that Al-Anon had published at that point. And I was hauling it around in a canvas sack to every meeting I was going to because I knew the answers were in the book. Didn't know what the questions were, but I knew the answers were in the book. And what ended up happening was my husband ended up going to AA 3 days. Well, he came home from treatment 4 days later and said, I need to be rigorously honest with you. And he told me a bunch of things that I did not know about him. Like I didn't know that there was not $25,000 in a bank account in Northern Virginia from his early out from the military. I had a huge fear of financial insecurity when I got here. I did not know that he had not graduated from college. He had dropped out as midway through his junior year to join the Army. I did not know that he had been kicked out of the Army for alcohol rehabilitation failure. And I did not know that this was not his first treatment center, it was his third. Oh, and by the way, one of them was a year long. Told me that on day four. And can tell you what he did after he told me that is he went to bed and slept like a baby. I did not. I stayed up all night and sobbed because I know today why I did that. Never, people said to me, didn't you think about leaving? No, why would I leave? Never occurred to me to leave. One, I loved him. But two, the more important reason why I didn't leave was because I couldn't figure out a way to make that look good. I've been married 2 months and I'm going to leave my husband. I'm going to look like an idiot. I'm not going to do that. So the next day he went to the treatment center, told them about his history, and they sent him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came home that very first night from Alcoholics Anonymous and said, I have to go to a meeting every day for a year. And I said, what am I going to do? And he said, well, I think you should do an Al-Anon, what I do in AA. They're basically the same program anyway. And that began the next 6 months of my husband sponsoring me in Al-Anon. If anybody's contemplating that, it did not end well for us. I'm just saying. But what it did do for me is I watched him work the steps. And I could see him working the steps. He was doing writing. He was meeting with a sponsor. He was going to meetings. I'm going to meetings. I don't know if they weren't talking about the steps. I don't know that I was hearing about the steps. I know I was not hearing about sponsorship when I came in. And I don't know if that's because they weren't talking about it or if I just couldn't hear it. I believe the family disease of alcoholism affects my hearing, and I oftentimes hear things that are not said. I don't hear things that are said. I've been known to have entire conversations in my head without people even being present. So it affects my hearing. So I don't know that I heard people in Al-Anon working the steps. I know I asked somebody about a sponsor and she said, oh, we just let the group sponsor you. And I thought, you people are all a little bit wacky. I am not telling you anything about me. So I'm not letting you sponsor me. But what happened was I ended up going to a conference, and we went to this conference at the beach. The only two speakers I remember hearing was Clancy was the AA speaker and Mary Pearl was the Al-Anon speaker. And the only way I can describe it to you is I was horrified. I could not believe they were talking about what they were talking about from a podium. Somebody was recording it in a room full of strangers. We call that a confession. You just don't do it. And but what happened was I walked out of that meeting and the taper, I must have looked like I'd been hit with a brick, because the taper looked at me and he gave me a set of tapes from a woman out of Cincinnati and said, hey, honey, listen to her. You might relate to her better. And he gave me a set of tapes of Kathy H. working the steps. And it changed my life. It absolutely transformed me. So I started listening to those and I started thinking about working the steps, and I needed to get a sponsor, and I started praying about a sponsor. And the question people ask me is, why work the steps? You know, just go to meetings, get the fellowship. That's great. For me, I did not change in meetings, and I still don't change in meetings. I get inspired to change in meetings, but I don't actually change in the meetings. I change by taking the suggestions of what other people have done in the meeting and applying them to my life. Why do I work the steps? Say, because they allow me to act better than I feel, right? I want to be transformed. I got here knowing I was unhappy. I got here knowing I was terrified. I got here knowing that at a very slight error on my part, my husband was going to escape my clutches. So I needed to hold on to him. But people were talking about working the steps. I think I intuitively knew if I worked the steps, I would change, and it scared me. And so it took me a little while. I always wanted to feel better before I took action. And what my sponsor said to me when I got a sponsor was, if you take the action, your feelings will change, right? You have to take action to change. And Eunice, that woman who was at that first meeting, said the reason she comes to Al-Anon is so that she will have the courage to change. And I wanted the courage to change. That's what I wanted to do. So what happened was I ended up getting a sponsor. She came in from Oklahoma. I was at my very first meet. I was at a Wednesday night meeting. First meeting she was at, and we were talking about the 12th step. And it went around the circle in my area, and we got around to me, and I said, oh, I haven't worked any of the steps, but I'm carrying the message. And it got around to her, and it sounded like she said to me, this is what I heard her say, oh, honey, you are not carrying the message. You are spreading the disease. Shut up. And I sobbed. Thought, oh my gosh, you hurt my feeling. I had one feeling when I got here. It was a big one, and it was all about being hurt. I was hurt. And went home. Kent said, what are you going to do? And I think we both thought I was going to say, I'm going to quit Al-Anon. And what I ended up saying was I was going to ask her to be my sponsor. And that's what I ended up doing. I eventually asked her to be my sponsor because I was going to run my husband over with a pickup truck. I thought I could make it look like a traffic accident. Told him I just needed one woman on the jury. I'd get off. And so when I called Luana and said, would you be my sponsor? She said, why me? I said, because I'm going to run him over with the truck, make it look like a traffic accident. She said, no, honey, why me as your sponsor? And I said, because I want what you have. And I didn't know what I was saying then, but I know today what I was saying. I knew what she was living with. I knew that she had a husband who wasn't in meetings. I knew she had a teenage son who had some behavioral issues. And I know she had a younger son who was developmentally disabled. And they were happy and they were content. And there was laughter in their house and they were having a good time no matter what. And I wasn't having any of those things. I was terrified. Absolutely terrified that Kent was going to meet somebody better suited for him in AA and leave me. And I said, I wanted what she had, and I wanted that serenity, and I wanted that peace, and I wanted that contentment no matter what was going on. And she said, are you willing to do what I've done for as long as I've done it to get what I've gotten? And I said, yes. Had I known what I was agreeing to, I probably wouldn't have said yes, but I said yes. And the very first thing she did was she started taking me through the steps. We started the steps using the book, Paths to Recovery, the beige book. It had just come out when I had come in, maybe the year I came in, a year after I came in. Luana started sponsoring me in April of 1999, and she's been my sponsor ever since. And she made me take a look at the powerlessness. Step one, I guess I should probably read the step as I do it. How about that? I've got a book. I have a couple of books because I do like information. So step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. I work with a couple of young people who are significantly younger than me. And what they have told me about is that little dash in between the first phrase of the step and the second phrase, it's called an M dash. And it's two separate phrases. I did not know that. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I thought my life was unmanageable because of his drinking. And that is not at all what I discovered when I worked the steps. I am powerless over his drinking. I'm powerless. I was unable to control his drinking, and I tried to. Early on, I remember negotiating with him about how much I was willing to spend for alcohol. I told him I would pay $6 a 12-pack because my theory was he was just going to pee it away anyway, so it's a waste of money to pay any more than $6. And we negotiated about whether that included tax or not. And I thought I was being generous when I said it did not include tax. So he could get a 12-pack of Red Dog beer for $5.99 at the Rite Aid grocery store. What I discovered when I got that credit card bill when he got sober was if you've got a credit card, you can stop at the gas station and you can buy beer. And between June and September, he had over $792 worth of beer on the credit card. And it was not Red Dog. And I was horrified because I thought I was controlling his drinking. We talked about it. He said he would cut back. I believed him. Turns out he just cut back in my presence. He just started hiding it better. So I understood the idea about being powerless over his drinking. I did not understand being powerless over alcoholism. I needed to learn what that meant to be powerless over alcoholism. And if I needed to learn what it meant to be powerless over alcoholism, I needed to know what it meant, what alcoholism looked like, what that meant. And I'm so grateful that my sponsor encouraged us to go to open AA speaker meetings so I could learn about the disease of alcoholism, because it's not just about my husband's drinking. I cannot control my husband's thinking. I can't control my husband's spending. I can't control my husband's actions. I can't control anything about my husband. And I didn't know that until I started working the steps. Today, I am not only powerless over my husband, I am powerless over everybody and everything in my orbit. My mother-in-law loves to ask me my opinion on things. What's your opinion on this? And I say to her, based on my job, I'm not allowed to have an opinion about that. And she'll say, oh, I know you're not supposed to have one, but I'm sure you do. And my answer to that is, actually, I don't. And that frees up an awful lot of time if I don't have to have an opinion about stuff. So I needed to know what it meant to be powerless over alcoholism. I needed to know what it meant to be powerless over alcohol. And then you look at that second half, that our lives have become unmanageable. My life was unmanageable because I was trying to manage it. My life was not unmanageable because I was trying to control his drinking. I was trying to control my own life. Self-reliance, self-will always gets me in trouble. People say, well, how do you know you're in self-will? I'm forcing a solution. That's usually a good sign. I'm trying to make this work out the way that I want it to work out. Early on, people used to say, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And I thought, that is the dumbest thing I have ever heard, because when I'm right, I am happy. And my sponsor gave me a slightly different way to look at it. She said, do you want to be right or do you want to be free? That was attractive to me. She said, if you can let go of your idea of how you think things ought to be, you've got a good shot at some freedom. And that's what I wanted to do. She made me look at early on about where I was trying to help. That's code for trying to be, trying to exercise some power. Some control. For me in step one, it's all about the control. I have a gal that I work with who I absolutely adore. And we were talking about control, and I kept saying to her, you're powerless over this. You're powerless over this. You're powerless over this. She said, I don't understand why you keep saying that. And I said, well, you're trying to control it. And she said, well, yeah. And I said, if you're trying to control something you're powerless over, you're going to struggle. And so I had her write down all the different words she used instead of control, to figure out where she was powerless. And when she'd come up with 185 different words she used for control, and all of those led her directly to where she was powerless over somebody or something, she said, one, can I stop making the list? And I said, yes, you can. So now look at where anytime you try and exercise that control or that power over something you're powerless at, your life becomes unmanageable. And that's what my sponsor has done for me. is I tend to go these days, if I'm struggling, I'm going to look at what I'm trying to manage first. Because if I'm trying to manage something, I'm usually trying to manage something I'm powerless over, right? My friend Ellen says obsession is all-out warfare on powerlessness. If I'm powerless over something, I am going to really try hard to exercise some control over it. And the reason for me, the reason I do that is because it is easier for me to be angry than it is for me to be afraid. And if I'm exercising some control, it gives me the illusion of power. If I don't have control, I can be angry and I can shoot that outward. If I'm not in control and I'm powerless, I get afraid. And if you look underneath all of my inventory work, what you're going to find is fear. It drives my life. That's where that fear of I'm either not going to get something that I think I need or I want, or I'm going to lose something that I think I need that I want. It's all self. It's all me trying desperately to control. So that's that step one of being powerless. Early on, one of the instances I was very, very powerless over was my inability to have children. And that was one of the very first things my sponsor made me work on, was this powerlessness about whether or not I could have children, because I wanted kids and I couldn't have them, right? That was clear. But the more I tried to force the solution, the more unmanageable my life became. And what I know today is that was just my lot. It's not good. It's not bad. I'm grateful for the gift of the steps, that I don't have to judge anything that's gone on in my life. But I have a different way of looking at things. That's the other thing the steps do. They don't change anything, any event in my past, but they change how I look at it. So I was powerless over not being able to have children. My sponsor has given me the opportunity to, if I can let go of that idea about being powerless over that, I can see where God's put babies in my life all over the place. Earlier on, I saw a little baby Lennon that I get to see on a regular basis. And then I've got another woman that I sponsor who's got a grandson, Keegan, that I get to see on a regular basis. And I've got a third gal that I sponsor who's got baby Sarah, who's not a baby Sarah anymore. My boss has got two boys who were the virtual school, have been hanging out in our office for the last couple of weeks. I got plenty of kids in my life if I'm willing to look at it. You know, they may not look the way that I want it to look, but that's okay. So that's my step one then and now, where I'm at now. I'm pretty much powerless over everything. And I want to be free. I don't want to be tied to old ideas. Step two, came to believe a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. When I got here, if you'd asked me about whether or not there was a power greater than myself, I may have said yes, but I didn't actually believe it. I thought there was a power as great as myself, not greater than myself. And that power as great as myself, that power was responsible for the big stuff. World peace, the Middle East, climate control, COVID. I was responsible for anything I get my grubby little hands on, you know? My husband, my mother, my sister, my dog, I'm responsible for all that. So I thought it was a power as great as myself. And what my sponsor pointed out to me is the actual words. I'm a wordsmith. I love the words. And it said, came to believe. That means I have to have some experience. And what she made me, she said, this is an experiential program. It's not an intellectual program. So what I want you to do, I want you to go back and look at where you've seen the hand of God in your life in the past. And I still do that today. And I was able to go back and look at all the times a power greater than myself had shown up when I wasn't expecting it. My husband and I met in high school in the Republic of Singapore in 1979. That's in Southeast Asia. He found me on the internet on February 1st, 1997. He was in Virginia, I was in Montgomery. I could not have figured out how to make that work. There's no way I could have figured out how to make that work. That has to be a power greater than myself. There's a young lady in this workshop with me. When we were working on her step two, I said, I had no idea. I was supposed to be at a particular conference on the West Coast that she was at because she needed to work with me and I needed to work with her. I had no idea how to make that work. There are people I see on this thing that I had the opportunity to meet and get to know. I had no idea when I met Ruth a few years ago that I was going to get to do this now, right? That's a power greater than myself. My sponsor also made me look at other little things about power greater than myself, like flowers. I love flowers. I kill flowers, but I love flowers. And she said, look at all the different kinds of flowers. Could you figure out how to make those flowers be those flowers? And the answer is no. And when she's had me start to look at those areas of where there had to be a power greater than myself, there had to be a power greater than myself that created all of these animals that would, a few years ago, I got to go, maybe I'll get to this story at some point. I will, step nine. But I got to go to Africa, and they have got gnus and antelopes and zebras and giraffes. And it occurred to me as I was out there in the middle of all of the Serengeti looking at all these animals, has to be a power greater than myself that was able to create all of these animals in such a way that all of the animals knew exactly who their peeps were. You never saw an antelope with, you know, coupling with a zebra, and you didn't have a zebra making out with a giraffe. Who knew how to do all this stuff? Not me. And I know that sounds very simplistic, but it's a simple program. And it was very important for me to get to this place where I could see all the things that I could not possibly conceive of. What I'm doing these days when I'm on a step two issue is asking myself, where am I currently agnostic? Where am I not believing that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, right? That's the other part of the step two that I had a problem with, was that a power greater than myself, ourselves, could restore me to sanity. I didn't think I was insane. I was looking at the legal definition of insanity. I did not think that I was going to be committed. One of the things my husband and I did early on in recovery was we bought a set of 1936 dictionaries, which is when they wrote the big book, between 1936 and 1940 is when they actually wrote and published the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where these steps come from. And the definition of insane, of sanity in 1936 to 1940, the first definition of it was soundness of mind, sound judgment, right? And my sponsor said to me, where have you not had sound judgment? Where have you not exercised soundness of mind? And she made me look back again. There's a bar here in town. I don't think it exists anymore, but it did for a long time. It was called The Gambler. It was off on the Southern Bypass, which is not the best part of town to go to. Didn't open until 11 o'clock. That tells you something about the bar. And I would go with the guy before Kent at midnight to The Gambler because I knew he was going to drink and play pool and gamble. And I thought I needed to be there watching him. Now, I don't know what I thought I was going to do if anything happened at The Gambler, but I needed to be there. And she said, does that sound like sound judgment to you, going to the bar at midnight when you have to go to work the next morning? No, that's not sound judgment at all. When he moved to Birmingham, I moved to Birmingham with him because I needed to watch him. And I was afraid he'd meet somebody else. And so I was living in Birmingham, north of Birmingham, which is 2 hours from my work. I was driving into Montgomery every day, driving back to Birmingham every day. That's 4 hours a day in a car. I was had an apartment in Montgomery while I was paying for an apartment for him in Birmingham. She said, does that sound like sound judgment to you? No, that's not sound judgment to you. I said, so do you want to be restored to sanity? That also suggests that I was actually at some point in my life sane. And I like that idea. It doesn't say that you're recreated out of nothing. And says, I'm going to be restored to sanity. And my friend Ellen says, when you restore something, you restore something of value. You don't restore something that's not valuable. And I like that as well. I want to be restored to sanity. I want to be restored to sound mind. I want to be restored to sound judgment. And that's what step two allows me to do if I'm willing to believe, if I will come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Doesn't have to, but he could. That also suggests I'm going to have to do some stuff, right? I cannot just sit in my office or on my couch and say, all right, zap me, get me, boom, give me the magic wand, do something. I'm going to have to take some action. We talk a lot about this being a program of recovery. It's an action program. I have to take action. So then we get to step three. And I guess, yeah, the people are worked up about step, you know, people, I don't know about this decision on step three. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. How many of us have heard the step three thing about the frogs? Three frogs are sitting on a log. One makes a decision to jump off. How many frogs are left on the log? Three, because he's just made a decision. He hasn't actually taken any action. That's what my sponsor said. Just make a decision. Are you willing to make the decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him? And I wanted to argue with him, with her about what does that mean, turn my will in my lives. And you'll notice it says will is singular and lives is plural. I think that means I got to turn my will and the lives of everybody I come in contact with over to a power greater than myself. That means my husband, that means my sister, that means my mom, that means my boss, that means the political situation. I'm turning all those lives, everything over to the care of a God of my, as I understood him. I'm not turning them over to the control. I'm not turning them over to the domination. I'm not turning them over for anything other than for him to take care of me. And if I can remember that he's going to care for me, that makes it easier to do. But again, this goes back to, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood him, I may not get my way. I may not get what I want. It may not look the way that I want it to look. And that's where I get hung up. Self-will. I want to do it my way. When I asked my sponsor, how do I know I've made the decision? And she said, you'll do the rest of the steps. That's how you know you've made the decision. God is not a terrorist. That's why she said, you can turn it over to his care. This is not a threat. It's his care. And what he promises is this or something better. That's what he promises. This or something better. But you got to trust and do the work. You can't just sit there and wait. I'm going to tell you a story many years ago, actually, when Kent and I were talking about dogs. We love dogs. Those who know me know we love dogs. And we were having this conversation about when we lost the two dogs that we had, getting new dogs. And Kent said, I want to get two puppies. And I said, well, I'm not sure I want to get two dogs. We were both in recovery at this time. And we were in the car, and we got to this place of him saying to me, look, I'm telling you, we're getting two dogs, whether you like it or not, and that's the end of this conversation. And I went, all righty then. Okay. Didn't say anything else. And so the next morning on my way to work, I am saying this prayer. I've done my prayer and meditation, but I'm still thinking about these dogs. I'm a little terrified that I'm going to come home to two new dogs. So I said this prayer to God. I said, God, you are going to have to do something about the dogs. Either you're going to have to change his mind or you're going to have to change my mind, because this is not tenable and I don't know what to do. So I'm turning this over to you. You're in charge of the dogs. And I am not kidding. 10 minutes later, I got a call from Kent, and he said, I get the feeling you might have felt a little bullied by my response to the dogs yesterday. And I said, yeah, I thought you were a little belligerent. He said, well, that's because I was belligerent and I was bullying you, and we won't do anything unless we agree on the dogs. And that was a wonderful example of my willingness to turn something over to the God of my understanding. The very first time I remember turning something over to God, we were on our way down to that conference. We had less than 2 months in to recovery. And Kent said to me as we were on the way down to the conference, I gave notice today, honey. And I said, that's nice. Notice of what? And he said, I quit my job. And I went, what? What I said was, wow, that's a really big decision, honey. When you make a big decision like that, I'd like to talk about that in the future, but I'm sure you made the right decision for you, because that's what you guys taught me to say. I'm clutching the steering wheel thinking, I have no idea who just said that. I'm income possessed by something. But the idea of, I didn't say anything else. I did not say anything else. We got down to the beach. I said a prayer to a God at that time I did not believe in. Please, God, you got to do something. And on the way home, and I didn't say another word, and that's a power greater than myself, not saying another word. And by the time we got in the car to come home, Kent said to me, you know, I think I may have been hasty on Friday. I think I'm going to go and ask for my job back. And I thought, oh my God. And he did. He didn't miss a day of work, didn't miss a paycheck. It was unbelievable. I'm like, oh, I can trust God. I can trust God. The area where I've had the most difficulty trusting God is obviously with my husband and with the money. Because for me, the money is a sense of security. I've worked very hard. I have some ideas about what I want us to do. It gives me a little bit of control. I recognize that. And so we struggled throughout our entire marriage with the finances. But this idea of trusting God. So I told you about the first time when Kent said to me, I quit my job today. This summer, in the midst of the COVID, we have a plan. We're going to retire next. I can retire in October. He can retire in May. And we're going to move. And he came to me at the beginning of August, I think, and he said, I can't do it anymore. He was having a really, really, really hard time with the teleworking. And he said, can I retire? And I said, well, I don't know, let me look at it. And so we looked at it. He was eligible, but it'd be a big, huge cut in our retirement benefits. And I said to him, we can do it if this is what you want to do, but you need to know, this is what the effect will be. And he said, all right. He went in and he came back. He said, no, you're wrong. Look, here's all the paperwork. This is what we'd make. I wouldn't lose a penny. And I said, honey, I love you, but you got the wrong code in there. He's like, I do. I said, yes, you do. Get the wrong code in there. And so, all right, I'll fix it. I'll go in. And he dropped his paperwork in. And he dropped his paperwork to retire before he checked the codes. And then he told his boss that he had dropped his paperwork in. Now, my prayer for my husband has been for a number of years, please, God, put people in his path he can hear. Because I know he can't hear it from me. Please, God, put people in his path he can hear. And so he told his boss after he had dropped the paperwork. And the boss said, can I talk to you about it? And he said, sure. That was on a Wednesday. On Thursday, he came home and he said, all right, so I've done the paperwork and I think you were right, which I always like to hear. And this is what it will be. Can we do it? And I said, if this is what you want to do, we can do it. We'll have to make some changes in our plan, but we can make it work. And that's this idea of when I made a decision to my will and my lives and my money over to the power greater than myself, I trusted God. I trust that God will do what we need to do. And that we'll be okay. And I really didn't mean that. And I did not have any angst about it. I talked to my sponsor about it. We reasoned it out. And I said, honey, I'll support you in whatever you want to do. But whatever you want to do, we'll do it. And so when he looked at the paperwork, and then actually the next day he went and he talked to his boss and he came home and he said, I don't think it's the financially responsible thing for me to do. I needed to talk to him. I've talked to him. I think there are things I can do differently. Leaving is not going to solve my problems. And I don't think it's fair to the family, not to me, but to the family, for me to retire. So I've withdrawn my retirement papers. Yes. But that I had to be willing to let him have his experience. That's the thing, man. I got to be willing to let him have his experience. So those are my step three, my 1, 2, 3 up to this point. It is, according to my clock, 2:54. So I'm going to, because we were a little late starting, I'm going to say take 6 or 7 minutes. Go do what you got to do. I'm going to drink a little water. I'm going to find my next set of steps and we'll go from there.